All right, gentlemen. I got no opening plan, so I guess first of all, the gang was in Denver. We were all in Denver, got to see each other. Although, as Charlie was just mentioning off the call, we didn't take any proof of participation on site as a group,
So
so
it
that was
never
a major
happened.
miss.
So it never happened.
Denver was a
We
vibe.
totally. Denver was super dope. Speaking of which, did you guys get the post-conference itis that was going around? I avoided it.
I got a little sick. It didn't set me back too far, but yeah, I got a little sick. Some other people were sick, were like put on their ass, but I don't know. Winners stay winning. I've got a healthy immune system.
I got 10-day COVID right before I went to that, so I think I was just exercised enough
Okay,
that
so
my
you're
body
patient
wasn't having
zero
it.
is what I hear.
Well, I mean, it was weeks before. So, yeah, I don't know what I just said, but it was not like I got better the day before I went to Denver, you know. But maybe I was carrying it, just not showing symptoms. Yeah, it could have been. You're welcome.
You were the super spreader.
Probably wasn't the other 100 sweaty drunk people in that basement. It was probably
Yeah, no, or Denver was super dope. What was your
was.
guys' favorite part? I think the house was my favorite part. Although Bitcoin Renaissance was amazing, I think the house was the vibe, especially that first night, which was like everyone was just like coalescing there.
Yeah, dude, that was really fun. I think the most exciting part about ETH Denver, just in general, like if we're going to call that whole thing ETH Denver, was that it was so much more. It wasn't just multi-chain on the Ethereum side anymore. There was a pretty strong Bitcoin presence, and there's never been a Bitcoin presence that I've seen at ETH Denver before. That was like, and it wasn't small. It wasn't like a few people who cared. There were two pretty major productions, being the house and the Renaissance, that. I don't know. Maybe I'm just wrong and I never saw it before, but it was like out. It was obvious this year.
Yeah, I'll say as somebody who's been to a lot of Bitcoin conferences over many years, you have the things which you talk about on stage and things which you talk about off stage. And Bitcoin as a culture had grown, the offstage conversations had grown to basically mirror and parrot the onstage conversations. And at ETH Denver, specifically or Denver, I found that the range of topics you could talk about to anyone was incredibly wide and diverse. The off-stage conversations were just as intellectually stimulating and novel as the ones on stage. And you didn't know what it was going to be. You could think you were talking to some like person who like had an artist or creative angle, but end up having a very deep technical conversation with them, and vice versa. And that's one of my favorite things is that I ended up, there was a guy who I thought I was going to talk about data availability with, and we ended up talking about obscure art house movies for like an hour. And like, you just don't get that at a normal Bitcoin conference. So shout out to the Hors d'oeuvre house and the changing culture that it brought.
I think the funnest part for me was meeting someone and not knowing how enthusiastic I needed to be when I said hello to them. Because I would say, hey, and then they would be like, hey, and it would be like, okay, names. Okay, yeah, that didn't do it. Twitter handle. Okay, that didn't do it. What about your Twitter PFP? And then it's like, oh, you're this person that connects here. We've actually chatted a lot. Like, this is a hug. Like, come here. Or it's like, oh, this is a handshake. Or yeah, this is a fist bump. Like I had some of these crazy connections where I'd never met these people in person before. I meet them, I finally connect to who they are. I'm like, oh, hey. And then they're like, wait, like who are you again? And I'm like, oh, I'm Bob Bodley. And they're like, oh, you're that Bob. And then yeah, like I don't know, like 20 times every day, just bumping into all of my amazing internet friends. You can't beat that.
That's Web3, baby.
Yeah, they need to make like you add your name, maybe you add where you work on your like placard, but then like a picture of like just like a screenshot of like the top of your Twitter profile and have it be on your lanyard, because that's how all of us know
Yep.
who the hell we're talking to.
That's what some NFT conferences do. I think because Paris was pr right before this, and I saw one of the badges from Paris, and I don't think they even had like doc's name slot availability. It was just your PFP and your Twitter handle. I
Yep.
think that's fine. I answer equally to my Twitter handle as I do my real name. In fact, I almost prefer it just for continuity.
I don't know if my pass had my PFP on it. Maybe someone just did that. Maybe someone like printed their thing out and put it on the pass. Mm. Unless maybe I just wasn't paying attention. No, actually at NFT Paris, they gave us wristbands. So someone must have made that. And then maybe that's the alpha. It's just like print.
Make it
print
yourself.
Whatever picture you're using that
make
week.
It yourself. Yeah, that's
yeah,
the alpha.
Yeah, print it on your lanyard. Make it double-sided. So if you're walking around backwards, you don't look like a dingle. Like
Witters did that with a leather jacket. She put her OMB like be on the back of a leather jacket for Amsterdam. That's Corey did quite that's the awesome. Same thing. Actually, he made a t-shirt with his PFP on it. Everybody knew.
Yep. Smart. Cool, man. Well, yeah. Good to see all you guys in person. Lots more to come. And I will mimic. Like, the array of discussions was super wide-ranging. Like, typically in the past, I have to, like, kind of holster stacks because it's, you know, a bad word. Like, I'm going to go to BTC++ in May, and, like, it'll be holstered again just because that crowd is still, they're still coming along. You know, we'll get them there. But this conference, no, totally fine. It was just another L2. Totally, like, what's the design trade-offs? Like, it should be. It's, like, actual discussion. Yep. That was refreshing as hell to see, and I think it's going to continue. Like, obviously, the Madeira conferences and BTC++ will be, like, lagging, but Bitcoin main conference is probably going to be like that. Like, it seems like the general culture is going to be that way, so exciting. Yep. Okay, let's pivot then. Charlie, I want to start with you because you got some news. This is going to come out after it breaks. So
yeah. So I am off to the next thing. So both Cypher and I, by the time you hear this, have left Luxor to go do different things independently. Great working for Luxor, really sharp team. I am joining Will Foxley to expand Blockspace Media. It's more B2B focused media company, and I'm pretty excited about it. A lot of people might not know, but my first job, my first W-2 over a decade ago, was actually doing local news for the NPR affiliate in my hometown. So I have, and I actually was going to pursue a career in broadcasting, but unfortunately, it wasn't intellectually stimulating. There wasn't enough money in it. So full circle, I had to pay my dues in data mining, Bitcoin analytics, other related entrepreneurial activity. And here I am back with the media business. It fits very well. I'm excited to do this. I've known Will for a long time, and we'll be bringing some other people in too. Yeah, so if you follow the mining pod, that's kind of the core, the one you might be familiar with. But also, I got a shout out. And I think we have some tech heads here. The Gwart Pod, I think, is the best podcast of this cycle. If you listen to, it's like up only from last cycle in terms of like the fun and familiarity of the ecosystem. But really just like a who's who of deep dive conversations in and around Bitcoin, but not exclusive to it. So there will be some other expansion to that media business. And I'm really excited.
Love it. Do you know what you're going to be doing yet? Like, are you going to have the Charlie show?
Yeah, so I'll be focused on anything ordinals and or what we might call Bitcoin season 2, which is a broad directive. And then it's similar to what I do for Luxor, which is just a general opportunistic business development. You know me, I can jump in and out of things which are somewhat technical. Hand that off to the super technical people, but then produce some value out of that. So there's a lot of things. If you look at the media model landscape, we're leaning more towards B2B, which is a more sustainable revenue model. There's not really like a good B2B publication that's Bitcoin focused in right now. They're typically owned by larger entities. CoinDesk is owned by it traded hands. You've got Blockworks, which is also a larger corporation. And then I don't want to poo-poo some others like Cointelegraph, but you have really a mixed bag of quality content. So this is leaning deep into the vertical of really knowing Bitcoin, tenured Bitcoin experience with an emphasis on mining and ordinals. So there's going to be a lot of things, though. I think this is the other thing is like a lot of these publications are traditional journalists who want to go into crypto. We are traditional Bitcoin and crypto people who flex journalism. And I think the ecosystem knows and wants this type of like media and product, because like the models which are traditional media have just not really succeeded in this business. I think you have to have industry experience first. So that's our take, that's our angle. I'm excited to have some milestones before the halving.
But you're just limited to Bitcoin season 2, just limited to essentially everything that will ever be done on Bitcoin in the future.
Which is now Bitcoin de facto, yeah.
Good luck.
Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of that. Every new cycle, there's a new media company that rises. Blockworks was last cycle's kind of rising winner. I think we're positioned to do that. A lot of these companies at a conference, so I wouldn't be surprised to see that sometime in our future as well.
Oh,
hell yeah. No, I love it. I mean, the it's definitely the tone you'll have from being Bitcoiners first and then happen to learn how to write and talk and all these things, like build out a brand, will give you a good perspective. And I had another thought, but I just lost it as I was talking, so we'll just scrap that. So cool, man. Congrats on that. That's exciting. And I've listened to Will's pod and Gort's pod. Both are fantastic. So, yeah, I think you guys are going to crush it. Cool. Then let's pivot. I want to talk about BRC 20s because we're in the.
Oh, yes.
Hell yeah.
And Bob, I don't know how well people know how much I hate BRC 20s, but I definitely am not a fan. You know, I like adoption coming to Bitcoin. Big market cap is cool for number go up, but I bought like exactly 2 BRC20s, and they're both like I can't even move them because I'll just lose money on fees. Then they're that uneconomical.
Is that why you don't like them, because of the friction?
Yeah, for sure. I think they make zero sense as a standard compared to like going up to an L2 or waiting for runes. But
can I make like a really brief statement here that I agree with you, and I want to say that like. We have roads and we have motorcycles, right? There's an entire sector of sport that is dedicated to using 2-stroke engines on dirt. Not because it's efficient, because it's like specifically because it's difficult. People do that. That's all I'm saying. People do that. They like doing it. They continue to do it. It's a massive industry. I think it's stupid too, but.
When they were first, like so like before there were roads, there were dirt bikes and dirt paths, so you had to go on them to get from A to B, and that's what BRC20 is. It's the dirt road and the 2-stroke motorcycle.
And people still do it, and it's still like its own thing. You know, there's all kinds of like, we'll set up barriers just to be able to hop over them as a species. So 100%.
I think we need a different analogy. I'm going to use, let's say you walk out of your door and there's a McDonald's right next to your house. Just really delicious cheeseburgers whenever you want. Now let's say 3 blocks away, there's like a really fancy burger joint. And you could go there too, but you end up going to McDonald's most of the time because it's so easy to just get a burger and feel the joy of McDonald's in your life. And it's especially when you have kids and, you know, your life is really busy and it's hectic. You don't want to have to wait and go somewhere else. You just want a burger and you're just going to grab it because it's so easy to just go and grab the burger.
That's the argument for runes.
That's the argument for BRC20. It's always been so easy to mint BRC20s.
But it's insanely difficult to transact.
The only thing I took from that analogy is that McDonald's is bad for you. BRC20s are bad for Bitcoin. That's the only thing I got from that analogy.
UTXO blow. Yeah, totally. 1,000 years in the future, we should be doing this. We also shouldn't be racing 2-stroke motors because they blow into the atmosphere. So I don't know. It's human.
It's right? So easy. It's so easy to mint, so easy to acquire, and so hard to sell. What else do you need for the perfect token? Go up. That's all you need. That's so easy angle. To get it's so hard to get rid of.
They're successful because they're so the friction to sell it is so hard. That's a good bull case I've not heard before. Well, so look, I mean, you know that so Unisat pulled back and said we're gonna play ball with the OP Indexer L1 Foundation. and I use the OPI indexer. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. OP indexer, OPI indexer. The indexer they're all going to use is open source. This allows the, whether you want to call them cartel or federation or critical mass of consensus, to more, to comparatively frictionlessly make changes to the protocol. I've talked a bit, a lot about this. You know, I talked a lot about this with the CBRC20 standard, which is basically just a strict improvement on it. But like, it's very obvious that for these standards and meta protocols to improve and become less stupid, they will have to add functionality and feature set in ORT. Because they start to break really quickly on chain. It gets way too expensive to do anything on Bitcoin in a high fee environment. And these are as small as they are, even though they're JSON, like they're still like a lot of bytes. So you can't transmit or transact like smaller amounts of these tokens. So I think I was glad to hear that there appears to be agreement between the parties who kind of make the decisions of the OPI indexer that they want to improve the functionality of the standard. I think this is good. I think this is important for the standard to stay relevant in the face of runes.
Go ahead.
No, you're fine. Go ahead.
I was just going to say this kind of lays the foundation for what comes next, which is what I'm calling BRC 22.0. This is still like not a lot of people are talking about it, but it is okay to talk about. BRC 22.0 is basically going to solve all of the problems that you think exist with BRC 20 right now. BRC 22.0, this is a Bob Coins term. They were going to call it like the financial module for BRC 20, and I was like, no way, this is BRC 22.0. So BRC 20 hasn't had an upgrade since the beginning. It's just been a straight standard, and everyone has been complaining because they haven't innovated. There's no airdrop functionality like you can do with TAP. There's no other kind of more advanced liquidity pool or staking or like any kind of functionality there. So the idea with BRC 22.0 is there's this programmability module. So you take an EVM smart contract, you inscribe that EVM smart contract to Bitcoin, and now you can run arbitrary EVM code on your BRC20s. So the indexer will go through, and now with your BRC20, you could like attach a smart contract ID of sorts, like an inscription ID for your smart contract. The indexer is now going to look for those, pull in that EVM code, execute that EVM code for your BRC20, and then that will then update the L2 state. The implications of something like this is you never have to upgrade BRC20 ever again. This is like one and done, the ultimate upgrade, and you have now unlimited programmability for your BRC20s. You don't have to keep defining new meta protocol fields. You don't have to keep defining new methods. You just enable EVM smart contracts, and now you can do whatever you want with BRC20.
That makes a lot of sense. I have some questions. Does the issuance of BRC20 stay the same, where you have to do the mint on Bitcoin's L1?
A good question. I'm assuming that this is a module that's added, so it doesn't actually change the BRC20 standard. So I would say deploys and mints are still happening on chain.
That would make sense, because at some point you do have to wonder if the standard has contorted so much that it barely resembles any of the reason we used it in the first place, or the reason that it was attractive in the first place. Or perhaps that was just a good bootstrapping narrative along the adoption path. I don't have a strong opinion. I think it makes a lot of sense, because right now, like talking about ETHDev, we saw everybody and their dog release an L2. Half of them were EVM on Bitcoin. And my question is, okay, like how, you know, okay, yeah, you can put EVM on Bitcoin some capacity, but how do you get people to use it? There, that is a very compelling liquidity migration use case to use your EVM on Bitcoin story.
Yeah, maybe. I'm not exactly sure how EVM L2s could plug into this, because it's basically the indexer is going to be upgraded with EVM compatibility, so you can run EVM code in the indexer. But yeah, I mean, EVM was a strategic choice because you have, you know, the wealth of infrastructure and tooling already built.
I have like a million questions, but I'm not even sure how to like parse them out. Because if you upgrade the indexer, I'm assuming there's always the underlying question of like how decentralized could the node be. Bitcoin is super easy to run. Like if you have a decent computer, it'll sync in like a day. I've tried to sync a Stacks node. Takes forever, way harder. You see how good and optimized Bitcoin is. Is indexing still pretty damn centralized? And so when it comes to like bolting on EVM, isn't that going to make it just harder for people to run indexers?
What is decentralization? Because there is an open source indexer which everyone can run, and then you can agree, or you can come to a state of BRC20 balances, but then what do we agree on? Like, how do we agree on that state? Is it just everyone confirming that, say, Unisat's running the Canon indexing client? If Unisat decides to deviate from that, is there recourse? Does everyone just like copy their deviation?
So this is the question of like, if you look at decentralization from one level as like the how easy it is to run a node to produce another copy of the ledger somewhere in the world. That's one angle. But you're saying there's a consensus angle, or like a verification angle of like, even if the node can catch up to chain tip, if you will, how is chain tip at the edge determined? Is that what you're saying?
Here's a wild idea that I proposed last May, kind of in jest. Let's say we had some kind of governance token which you could stake against your BRC20 indexer, and you got slashed for bad behavior, and then we figured out who got to take turns updating the BRC20 state, and we just now did proof of stake on Bitcoin for BRC20. I don't think this is that crazy of an idea. I think this is actually we're trying to figure out the sequencing problem.
Yeah, I would say on the OPI side, what they do have is a nice place where you can go and look at all of the current state hashes for all BRC20 indexers. This is a step in the right direction because you have verification. Verification meaning everyone has the same thing that they report. What you don't have is validation, so you don't know, you don't have proof that they didn't just grab someone else's state and, you know, stick it in there. Like, you can't prove that they actually did it. You just have this soft consensus-driven or soft community-driven consensus where everyone basically has the same state value. So it's reasonably likely that you all have the same indexing happening. This is like a soft step towards decentralization. It's not all the way, but it's better that we can at least verify that everyone's on the same page and that we have an open source implementation of the indexer.
I would say BRC20 is much more decentralized today than it was 2 months ago. And I think it will probably mimic more of like a federated model going forwards, which I don't think is that bad.
Yeah, that's what popped up in my head too, is like proof of stake makes sense as far as like, it allows open membership. As long as you have capital, you can get into the governance structure. The only other alternative, really, if you're not going to have proof of work, is federations for the most part. So you kind of have those two. So it's making me question, like, proof of stake but on Bitcoin sounds, now it's semi-acceptable, even though up to this point a year and a half ago, it was like, that's recreating fiat, it's elitism, it's all these things. So it's just kind of like the war of two worlds, where it's like Liquid's been doing a Federation forever and they've been poo-pooed, but now we're using it in these L1 things because it's the L1, because it's cool, because we're on the bleeding edge. But Proof of Stake, which has been there forever, and Liquid Federation's been there forever. These are not new, but they've just been rebranded for like at some level.
I know this is gonna get clipped, but I don't think Proof of Stake is like this bad boogeyman thing. I think it's a pretty compelling, robust way to come to consensus. I don't think it's the way you define consensus for Bitcoin, the most important blockchain. But I think you can come to consensus around important things like, say, token state for a decade or two on Bitcoin. It's not something I'd want to like bet on a 50-year time horizon, but I think novel consensus mechanisms should be explored.
You know, once we have proof of stake securing indexers that can run EVM code, we're basically building Ethereum on Bitcoin.
ETH is the L2, baby. Solana is the L2, and Ethereum is the L2 of Bitcoin. That's fair. There's your multi-chain thesis.
My brain hurts.
Because once you have proof of stake, you're going to want to accrue value to that token. So you're going to want some EIP 1559. You're going to want some BRC20 cost to actually transact on the protocol. And that's EIP 1559. And you're going to want to start to do batch transactions for BRC20, which is like a sequencer. So now you have, you know, a sequencer that's collecting batch transactions, sticking them all on Bitcoin. Now you got a roll up of sorts. I mean, we're just building a blockchain on top of a blockchain.
do we think that the new sexy BRC20 will love that?
Did you see the one earlier too, where I had a pen in my hand and it just made like a thumbs up emoji? Is this a setting that I have enabled?
You're being punked right now.
Nobody else has. I have it.
Oh, I got it. Let's go.
Hey.
Let's go.
Cool.
Okay. Anyway, anyways, do we think does the new sexy BRC 22.0 take away from the Runes narrative?
I think a lot of the narrative has to do with the person who put it together and the fact that it doesn't leave behind UTXOs, which are both still true advantages.
With BRC... Yeah, sorry, Charlie, you go. No, I'll go.
Okay. I think one of the... If you're trying to think long-term, which of these is going to be easier to scale on a layer 2? And right now, Runes is much better suited for that. On a short term, I think it's entirely narrative driven. So right now, Runes in the driver's seat of the narrative, but we know how these things can play out, and that if the narrative shifts to BRC20, if you can introduce a narrative catalyst in the BRC20 2.0, that seems like a very compelling bullish case for it.
Just wait until you accidentally burn all of your Runes tokens because you forgot to include the specific transfers or tokens in your UTXOs. That's going to be a fun narrative. Essentially, you can hold a whole bunch of Runes in the same UTXO, but in your transaction, you have to specify what to do with those tokens. Early on, it was if you didn't do anything with the token, it would just be burned. Like the transfer wouldn't succeed. And because it's UTXO based, you have a new UTXO. So now your Runes tokens are not in this UTXO because you didn't tell the previous in the previous transaction what to do with the Runes tokens. So you could have a whole wallet of Runes tokens in a UTXO. And if you like, if a website accidentally creates a bad transaction for you, you could lose all of your Runes in one Bitcoin transaction.
Now, Casey calls this like the rolling Runes bounty, where you actually send them all out and then they just begin to kind of like snowball within that UTXO. There's going to be a lot of Runes. There's going to be some people who fuck up some Runes transactions. Just like,
because you can spend his fees if the wallet, yeah. Like, you know how Unisat spends Kurt's inscriptions? Like, imagine you can spend the whole on balance in one UTXO by accident.
So does that move?
So
Does that
people
move
are going to
most
have.
of the user flow to the wallet then? Because I saw XFirst announce the Runes testnet today. So like there's going to be new tick boxes when I'm sending runes to make sure I don't F something up.
Well, and as a provider, you're probably going to want to have separation of tokens. Like you're not going to want to put all the tokens in the same UTXO because that's crazy. You're going to want to have a hot UTXO and a cold UTXO. You're going to want to have different UTXOs for different tokens. That's the downside of runes. Like I think there are going to be some limitations in what you can do, and it's going to be a fairly rigid protocol, I think. And so I don't think runes is the silver bullet for Bitcoin DeFi. I think a lot of people love it because Casey's doing it. But with the BRC20 2.0, you have this crazy flexibility of basically doing any compute you could ever want on BRC20. There are even ways to do like start doing some batching. So I think BRC20 makes a comeback because runes won't be able to do everything that people want it to do. There will be limitations. There will be a ceiling on kind of the functionality you have. So.
That's a, I like that take, Bob. Here's my spicy, goofy take. It's been a little bit of an industry joke that XFirst separates the fungible and non-fungible balances within the app when you don't really need to. Maybe it was actually a Gigabrain play because now they can have fungible ordinals and runes addresses.
I was just going to ask if
just
there was going to be a nested SegWit separate side, just a different BC1 queue or something like that, specifically for runes. I don't really know.
one argument to back up XFirst here: if you have ordinals that are not indexed currently, they're indexed somewhere, but they're not indexed in your wallet. The reason why you separate your addresses is because you don't index them, but someone else does, and so they send it to their ordinals address, and now you're guaranteed to not spend it as fees because it's sitting in an address separate from your fees. So from an indexer perspective, it's actually smart for XFirst to do something like that. That's just the use case for why it's nice.
It's like an extra backstop against it's just like a
An indexer
it's like a
misalignment.
dumb backstop and it works pretty well. It makes it really
Yeah.
hard in troubleshooting, but yeah. It's not that
Also, in
bad of an idea.
choosing SegWit instead of nested SegWit, they are the most compatible old to new in terms of wallets. You can do anything from an XFirst wallet where you can't with other wallets because they don't use like conventional SegWit, which I think is the most backwards compatible, right? Like you can transact with a legacy address only with XFirst, correct?
So
If we're arguing about whether or not it's necessary to do it the way they did it, I think it was super smart because you can't send from legacy. The funny thing about ordinals is you don't actually need Taproot anywhere ever.
Learned that recently.
You only need Taproot to inscribe. And so you actually could use any wallet address. Like on Bionic, we don't even use Taproot addresses at all. We just use normal legacy addresses because it's fine. I think I don't actually know what address format we use, but you don't need Taproot anywhere. You could hold ordinals in any, I mean, it's just Bitcoin.
You know how I learned that? I learned that because I drew a picture of a hamburger and I wanted to send it to Jeremy Rubin. And I asked him for a Taproot to send the hamburger to, and he gave me a SegWit. And I was like, either, and like clearly we know the answer to this, either he doesn't know the secret that he needs a Taproot address, or I don't understand Bitcoin. And it's probably the latter. And it turned out to be the latter. I learned.
Yeah, the it does come into play for BRC20s because in order to transfer, you have to inscribe a transfer function, which
Correct.
there's plenty of people who have accidentally sent their BRC20 balances to addresses which they can never extract them from, short of it, a whole protocol upgrade. Really, it would be an upgrade of ordinals consensus itself, broadening the definition of an inscription. This is a very, very hot take here, so.
Although you don't have to be the one to inscribe the BRC20. Anyone can inscribe the BRC20 to your account. to activate your balance.
Oh, shoot. I didn't even think about that. See, this goes to like how little I think about BRC20 sometimes.
So technically, you could have a wallet that is not Taproot, and you just say, you know, tell some service, hey, inscribe this to my balance, and then it'll do it, and it'll activate your balance, and then you can do things.
I learned something new today. So
I kind of get it. I'm halfway confused.
But that's so dumb. Oh, my God. Okay.
So let's say you have a balance of 1,000 Ordi token in your wallet. I can inscribe a transfer to your address that will activate a balance for you. And now you hold, because it's just a transfer. It's just a valid transfer. Anyone can inscribe it to your address. Now that you have the address, now you can send that anywhere you want. This is actually how we do our BRC20 bridge. This is the way we do a non-custodial, like fully decentralized BRC20 bridge, is we have, because ICP smart contracts can't inscribe, it's really hard to do inscribing in a decentralized way, but the user...
Charlie is right.
Got me thinking. Okay, so like now these transfer functions don't actually technically have zero use case. Now you could have a whole marketplace for transfer inscriptions if the actual bytes to inscribe a new transfer increase the economic feasibility of sending that. You could just buy that single dust output with a transfer function on it, and you could buy that to then unlock and send your BRC20 somewhere.
Wait, say that again.
So, like, imagine that it was too expensive for me to inscribe the 80-something bytes of a transfer function, and instead I just paid you out of band or on-chain to give me your transfer inscription so that I can then transfer. This opens up a whole new design and logic challenge, but this is really, really goofy. This has got me thinking now.
Is there a reason why... I'm guessing it's a byte limit thing. People just don't batch the buy, the transfer one transaction. So you pay once, get both, and it's unlocked when they both hit your wallet. Like, why is it not a UI thing already?
What you're saying, inscribe the transfer and...
Like, you do a mint, and as you're minting, it's also going to send the proper JSON whatever, and it'll mint and transfer in the same transaction. So you're buying both in one transaction.
I would have to look at the actual logic. Maybe you know it, Bob, but I wonder if the indexer doesn't consider intra-block balance changes.
It has to be indexed first before you can do a transfer to be valid.
Yeah, I wonder.
Well, no. Within the same block is fine.
Okay.
You can deploy a token and mint the entirety of the token in the very next transaction in the same block. That's fine, because it just goes in order. What I'm wondering is if in the reveal of your mint inscription, could you commit for a transfer inscription in the same Bitcoin transaction? That feels crazy, but would save you a transaction.
This is a Cyphor question. tune in next week to get Cyphor's answer, because he's the only person who will know.
We're also going to join the OPI Federation so we can fix BRC20.
We need to sign on as a federated signer. The Boys Bitcoin Club or whatever this is.
But not a Bitcoin Club.
Yeah, does anybody actually know the name? I don't.
Is the OPI indexer or the?
No, this.
Oh,
not on like a Bitcoin podcast.
Yeah. Something like that.
Yeah, that's probably the most proper one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, we went down a BRC20 rabbit hole. Dang.
We did. That was actually good. I learned a lot.
Yeah, I didn't know what BRC 2.0 was at all until today, and I still don't fully understand it.
Yeah, I'm also still. At a high level, I'm probably still pretty, I'm thinking longer term in, 1,000 sat V-byte normal environment. And I think most of the stuff on the L1, I mean, the Ordinals crowd knew this from the jump of, inscribing on Bitcoin's effing expensive. So it's going to become a luxury item sooner than later.
You think 1,000 is going to be normal? You think the comma is going to be there permanently? Really?
I do, for sure. Shit. Yeah. Especially as... the thing people are talking about is, like, it's not just L1 activity directly from users and, like, big whales. The L2s are going to be very economically dense very quickly. Citria, Staxbitters, Bob, the Rootstock, they're all going to settle down, and they're going to give a really robust floor that's going to steadily rise as those L2s get used. And it's kind of a feedback loop. As the L1 gets expensive, the L2s get used, and it's just like this. It goes like this. So, I don't know. I think most of this stuff, when it comes to tap and track and whatever, yeah, I get made fun of by my wife for talking my hands way too deep.
No, I love it.
But
I think it's clear. You're being clear.
Yeah. So I think the way that the Ordinals crowd sees digital artifacts as luxury items in the near future, I can't imagine fungible tokens don't go the same way. Like, there's going to be big balance fungible tokens and then a bunch of uneconomical ones. And they'll have to go to an L2 sooner than later. So, I don't know.
Also, I'll say it's like, if, you know, the game or the, like, the ones which are most compelling are the ones which most naturally fit into some kind of L2 scalability, which is why Runes appeals to me more, because it's UTXO based. It actually, you don't have to kind of fit it into some kind of scalability model. It naturally, you can lock a UTXO, and that UTXO it just fits right into the various layer 2 scalability options like Lightning or Mercury layer, like a state chain.
Totally.
Yeah. I use L2 loosely because I know Bob says there are no L2s.
May I ask a quick question? If you look back at, I didn't even wait for you to answer, I guess I'm just going to do it. If you look back at fees in the past when Bitcoin was worth under $20,000 per, not that we should be measuring Bitcoin in dollars, but you know what I'm trying to do here. Fees were like high compared to now in sats, because sats were worth less than they are now. So, like, in my head, if we extrapolate that, even if the network gets busier, one sat is going to be so much more valuable shortly than it was before. Thereby, the USD fees might be the equivalent of current modern day, like 1,000 sats per V-byte kind of here and there. Wouldn't that look more like 300 sats per V-byte in that time frame?
Like, if Bitcoin hits $1 million, then who cares what the fee rate is? It's going to be expensive to transact on Bitcoin.
Right. And then fewer people will do things because the cost will be too high. Thereby, network traffic will reduce, or at least effectively, in a way. It just feels like it's always going to be as low as it can be. And 1,000 seems really high, especially when Bitcoin's, you know, a mil or, you know, 100 million, right? If it's a sat per dollar, like $1,000 a transaction just seems absurd. But maybe that's just, maybe that is the future. I don't know.
This is why, you know, if you assume that is one user per one transaction or one UTXO, then it seems incredibly expensive. But this is why there's a lot of advocates for what we might call UTXO sharing improvements, like CTV or even CAT, which allow multiple users to basically conduct economic activity with one transaction or, you know, fewer UTXOs than there are users. This is why I think one of the catchphrases of the future is, we don't want UTXO ownership to be an elite group. UTXOs are for everyone.
Good point. Thanks.
Yep, I like that. UTXOs are for everyone. Yeah. Other than that, I think it's right. Like, sats per V-byte is kind of a crude metric because it's kind of more of how much does it cost me as a user relative to the thing I'm doing. Like, when fees are cheap, I'm sending $100 in Bitcoin, it might cost me 1%, 0.5%. So there's not much reason to go to Lightning. But when it's 5 or 10, you got to change how much you're sending to make it worth your time. So
right, if you're buying a condo and it costs you $20,000 to send 2.5 million, you're like, percentage wise, it's like doable.
Exactly.
And fast and reliable.
Yep, exactly. Cool. Any last thoughts, guys? I mean, we're coming up on time. Anything else to throw on?
Plenty going on at the moment to talk about. Nothing in terms of tech that I can think about. You know,
I've reached, I would describe it as, you know, you have inbox escape velocity, but I've reached Ordinal's commentary escape velocity. I can no longer keep up with all of these spaces, the commentary, the threads, or the discords. I think I tweeted yesterday that there were four simultaneous spaces, two of which I really wanted to tune into, but I was running Ordinal's Coding Club with Casey and Raph. So it's like, I think this is good. This is healthy for the ecosystem. It means that it's probably time to figure out how to optimize your information stream so that you don't go insane. So this is the perennial case that happens in a bull market. You have to either trade brain cells for sand, you know, yeah, literally spend brain cells, or figure out how to narrow your information diet. So
I've been thinking that a lot this week. This week has been a maelstrom, firestorm.
Stack sats and prioritize mental health.
Yeah, I mean, the answer is pretty clear. You listen to Build on Bitcoin, you listen to None Other Podcast, and you listen to Blockspace Media, and you pretty much get pretty good coverage, maybe some Bob Bodley threads. I think you're Gucci.
Get a bigger monitor, that too. I can say this from personal experience.
Did you get one? This dude bought, just for context, people, he was at East Denver. He was at Bitcoin Renaissance shopping for that monitor just on Amazon. Like, should I just blow a few G's? Yeah, I'm going to do it.
It wasn't that. It was like $700 because it's an LG Ultra Gear, not a Samsung whatever. And it's still 5240 or whatever by 1440. It's a bit pixelated more so than like a Retina screen, but you can like lay everything out and have, you don't have to like bit your windows apart, pick the one you want to get back to. You don't have to waste all the time doing that. It does require a different level of organization, but so far it's helped me a lot, I think.
Love it. Well, new internet, new screen, new Donnie in Puerto Rico. Yeah.
It's wider than movies though, which is a little confusing because like the screen's this wide and then the movie's this wide. And I'm like, what?
Yeah.
There's like a way we can do this better. I don't know. If I had to redo this, I wouldn't buy an ultra wide. I would just buy a wide monitor because I'm frankly, this is a bit much, but
yeah.
Don't know till you know.
What? Okay. I'm gonna add one teaser for the people for next episode. I'm trying to get Matt Luongo from Thesis to join us. First guest on whatever the show is called. OG Bitcoiner, so it'd be exciting. But he said something on stage at Bitcoin Renaissance about fee burning Bitcoin as a viable economic security model. And like in certain circles, that's like heresy to burn this pristine collateral. So I think that's gonna be one of the things that we'll jump into is, does it make sense long term to burn Bitcoin to make everyone's number go up and it helps the security model?
Can you briefly recap that so that I know what fee burning, like I understand the concept of burning fees, but like how do you do that on Bitcoin and why would anybody even propose it?
Well, on Bitcoin, it's as straightforward as you just send it to an address that's inaccessible. And so a lot of networks like Rootstock and Stax have portions of their consensus burn a fee that goes to an address no one can access. And they do it for different reasons, but Matt's point is something like, Is the long-term security model of Bitcoin to make number go up for holders or miner revenue? That's like a big debate. And burning Bitcoin, I think, benefits holders more. I think that's his argument. So there's a whole discussion to be had there.
But it would do both if Bitcoin's worth more than fees and block rewards are more money, technically, if less is in circulation. But isn't the halving already like taking care of that for us in the time frame where it's relevant, which is like another 100 and some odd years? Maybe this isn't a conversation for today, but
these are the good questions. These are the good questions, Donnie.
Okay, but I'll end it with this one major question. Why would Rootstock do that is it just an altruistic effort? Or do they directly benefit by sending
out their portion? I don't know on Rootstock. I know on Stax they have...
Like, why would any one entity do that?
The way proof of transfer works on Stax, you have these things called reward slots, and there's two every block, and you have to have this burn phase to make the reward slots be not front run or something. I don't know the exact mechanism, but I'm not sure on rootstock. I just learned about that from Sergio, who posted on my Twitter saying we burned some trees too. That's all I know.
Normally when you burn, it's because you're increasing issuance. And so the argument could be, rather than cutting the block fee in half, the block subsidy in half every halving, let's stop so we can preserve fees going straight to miners. And to make up for that extra issuance, we now add a burn mechanism on all of these places. So now supply stays 21 million or lower, but we've actually stopped the block subsidy from going down because we've increased burn. And this is also kind of heresy in lots of circles, because now you're talking about increasing issuance for miners perpetually, because you have like these inflationary mechanics and now deflationary mechanics with the burn, and the burn overcomes the issuance. And so you still end up with a stable supply of Bitcoin. I don't know if that's relevant.
I look forward to talking about that next time, because I think I have a lot of feelings on that.
That's a good way to end it. I think that's the episode, guys.
Yeah.
Good chat.
Hell
yeah.